Remember to breathe.
Yes, a very good day to you wherever you are, whatever time it is. It's Chris Walker and Jerry Hassan.
Yes, good day, good evening.
Kubrick Book Week, which is just coming up around the corner, and we've got the lovely Naomi Johnson with us this morning to talk about her book, 15 miles an hour-ish around the world, a cycle around the world, a real adventure, Naomi. A pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
So, you have been on several amazing journeys through your life, most recently battling your cancer diagnosis, which you're doing a tremendous job. You're looking really well.
Thank you.
But before we come to that, and part of your book week talk is all about going around the world at 15 miles an hour, when you decided, and I want to find out how you decided, to jump on your bike, find someone who was going to be as crazy as you to do it, who actually you ended up marrying, and...
Chris, you've given away the ending of the book already.
Yeah, I know, but everybody knows that in Kukubri. But I want to go back and say, how did that all start?
Gosh, okay. So I need to take you back probably a good 10 years. I was living in Edinburgh, beautiful city. I was
my favourite city.
I love it. I was in my, I'd like to say early 30s. I was approaching my mid 30s by then. I was chief exec of a new organisation, a national charity supporting social entrepreneurs across Scotland. And for anyone that's set up any kind of new business, whatever sector you're in, it's pretty hard work.
Yeah.
And I think the combination of having a job where I was working significant hours and I was enjoying living in the city. Yeah. I think there's a lot to do in Edinburgh and I was making full use of it. I think you eventually get to a point where, frankly, you're shattered. And I guess as a woman, you start doing I'm in my mid-30s. Do I want a family? Do I want children? What am I doing? And you're starting to kind of think, I need to work out what the next stage of my life is. And if I'm being honest, the next stage of my life was not cycling around the world at that point when I started to question it. I knew I wanted to quieten my life down a little bit, not necessarily on the work front. Those of you who know me now will know I haven't quietened down on the work front. I'm still super busy. But I perhaps wanted to live a life where everyone talks about balance. I wanted a bit more balance. So I started looking for options. And actually, at the point when the world cycle came into mind, I was in the last five of quite a good job moving up to the Highlands, mm-hmm. thinking that the Highlands would give me that slightly quieter life. And then one of my colleagues sent me a link about a talk that Mark Beaumont, the Scottish cyclist who got the mm-hmm. initial world record for going around the world.
There's his book.
Indeed, fabulous book.
Great book.
Really inspirational. Yeah. I mean, he inspired me. That's really important to say. So he was doing a talk in Edinburgh and my colleague sent me a link and she's like, it's free, we're going, do you want to come? And I saw the link and it came through and I said, Kim, he's not just doing a talk. I said, he's organising a trip that you can sign up for to follow his route and, you know, a semi-supported tour. And she just looked at me and she went, oh my goodness, that's what you're going to go and do, isn't it? And I knew at that point the seed had been planted. So I was at that cusp, really, of a big, I guess, looking at my life and making some big changes. So I went to the talk. At that point, I was ready to go for a second interview for the job in the Highlands. As I said, into the last five, pretty good. And a phone call came through one day and actually it said, you haven't got the job. And it's really weird because you're always... I've never been so joyous that I hadn't got a job in my life. But actually, I knew at that moment that what I was then going to do was this cycle tour. Mm. And at that point, I'd already set a bit of a seed in my father's mind that that's what I was going to do. He wasn't particularly keen on plan B. He preferred plan A, as any traditional parent would. But the seed had been planted, so knowing I hadn't got the job, I didn't start looking for anything else, actually. Afterwards, I had a house in Bristol that I'd been renting out since I'd moved to Scotland. It went on the market, and I was ready to go. That was what I was going to do. So we were in the middle of winter. I love my cycling, but I prefer it in the sunshine. I think we can all say that. Mm-hmm. So I took to just doing spin classes. So I was doing 11 spin classes a week. I was, you know, really getting into my fitness. I was a bit trimmer then. It's a good job this is a podcast.
You look great to us.
Thank you. And I was ready. But then people will hear more about this in the talk. And I do get quite emotional, and I can't stop myself. I'm really sorry about that. We're all human. But I'd signed up for this trip, and in early January, what actually transpired is there weren't enough people to make it a viable enterprise, so it got cancelled. And I remember going out with my friends that evening, and they're kind of like, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, I decided I was cycling the world, so I'm going to try and find a way of making it happen. And a few days later, a post came in. So when we all signed up to do the trip, a Facebook group had been set up of other people that were interested. And we were all asked not to say anything until they tried to contact everyone that the trip had been cancelled. But as soon as we knew that they'd done that, we got the email going, right, you can chat to everyone else now about it. And very quickly, a post popped up in the Facebook group going, I've still got the time, money and inclination. Who's up for it? Well, me. I was up for it. So I didn't know this guy from Adam. Never met him. We'd been chatting a bit on the Facebook group. He'd started training. I'd started training. He lived down in Buckinghamshire. I was pretty sure I was going to get on with this guy because he was my route to cycling around the world. And so we started chatting and we started planning a trip. And we decided we probably wouldn't cycle through bits of Pakistan like the original route had done, just with the two of us. So we started planning this 12-month tour. And I guess this is a bit that's always tough. And I guess this is the thing about things being cyclic and coming round in circles to some degree. I got a call just a few weeks after I'd arranged this with John, about 3 weeks later, and it was a call from my mother. And actually, my mother had just been told she'd got her breast cancer was back, but was terminal. And, you know, I thought hearing my trip was being cancelled the first time was hard. Hearing it was being cancelled the second time, and actually as an only child, I was potentially about to go on a pretty tough journey with losing my ma, was, I have to say, some of the darkest days actually of my life. When you first hear that news, it was really tough.
Yeah.
She felt awful because my trip was cancelled. I felt awful because I was going to lose my mum and my trip was cancelled. You know, I'll be honest, I was devastated that my own life was changing a plan. So I told John that the trip was off again. He was devastated. I was devastated. But a few months or even a few weeks later, it became apparent that my mum's diagnosis wasn't quite as rapid as it could have been. And I rang John and I said, right, I said, I can't do 12 months, but I can do 2 5-month trips because I'm not missing Christmas.
Yeah.
So if it's going to be my last Christmas with my mum, I want to be home for it. So we agreed we'd do 2 5-month trips. So we started in America because language was easier. There's already routes down the Pacific Coast Highway. We thought that would be a good introduction.
Mm.
And then we planned a trip that at that point included going from America. Then we wanted to go to Japan. Then we were going to go into India and Nepal. And then we were coming home for Christmas. And then we actually signed up to do a supported trip that went Cairo to Cape Town. And then we did that very deliberately so that if we didn't get on, we could both still enjoy a significant cycle route.
Yeah.
And if we didn't speak to each other on the second cycle route because there were other people on it, well, so be it. That wasn't what happened. And actually, we ended up doing 5 5-month trips. And given... you've already said where the book ended up. We got on pretty well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was, I mean, significant life-changing moments, really.
Yeah.
Can I ask you before we get into the whole trip, before you did this huge thing, right, what's the longest, like, cycle trip you'd actually undertaken?
Gosh, I'd done Land's End John O'Groats.
Ah, right.
So I'd done that one, again, cycle touring with my panniers, camping. I remember it being particularly bad weather for most of the time it took to do that. I had done a couple of organised long cycle holidays, like three weeks or so. I'd done one around Sri Lanka and I'd done one through Vietnam, but they were very much, you pay your money to a tour company and everything's organised for you. And other than that, I guess I'd just done wee trips, you know, going around Arran, going around a few of the other Scottish islands. Scotland's the most amazing place for cycle weekends and trips and tours. But I'd never done anything of this length. And actually, it became apparent on the first night in America that John had never done this. So I'd never actually asked him whether he'd done any cycle touring. I just... We spoke about cycling a lot, and I just assumed he had.
That's the trouble with online dating, isn't it? And personas.
Absolutely. People tell you the bits they want you to hear, and you listen to the bits you want to hear as well. So on the first night in America, John put up a tent for the first time on his first full cycle tour. And I guess at that point, I knew we were in for a big adventure.
When he was looking at the ends of the... Where is this going?
Absolutely. I never thought I'd be the one giving people advice on pitching a tent. Yes. I'm not very practical.
What do you do with these? So I mean, that was what an amazing start to a life together that you've both had. And I don't want to give too much away on the talk, and the whole purpose of the podcast is just to talk, skirt around the main event, because no doubt you'll be digging deep into the book. But let's just talk about writing the book. So were you writing it as you went, or did you come back and think, right, I'm going to write it all now? Are you keeping a diary? How did it all work?
Gosh, I guess for anyone that's set about writing a book, I'd imagine there's many more unfinished books out there than there are finished books. So writing the book took longer than the cycle trip because I started it and then you kind of, then you put it to one side and then you start it again and then you put it to one side. So while we spent a few years on our cycle tour around the world, it was 10 years really from start to end to get the start of a book and the end of a book, which is terrible, but that's just because by nature I get drawn into so many other things. I did keep lots of notes during the course of our travels because, again, if you're going to... There's a really careful balance in writing a book of this type. Some people do enormous amounts of detail on every day on a shorter journey, and you get that a lot with, I guess, more the world record kind of tours and the very day-to-day challenges. If I'd have gone into that much detail in a trip that was, you know, 32,000 kilometres over what ended up being five month trips, I would still be writing the book now and no one would ever want to read it. Yeah. So again, you're trying to work out which are the things that you think people will find most interesting from your diaries and trying to get a real mix of the cycle story mixed in with the life story, mixed in with, I guess, the relationship story and some of those dynamics. So I hope at the end I got a reasonable balance. So yeah, my diaries were a big thing that informed that, and the blogs that we both wrote as we went through.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, you've got a line in your book where you say about your, in terms of travelling, how you also love coming home. But of course, by coming home, home is changed, and I've read that. It's like there's the Frank Sinatra line about it's very nice to go travelling, but it's so much nicer to come home. But it's a different home, isn't it? It's obviously a different home in a sort of metaphorical sense, but also you moved to D&G.
Absolutely, and I actually think one of the things I was really keen to get through in the book. Everyone talks about their trip, and very few people will talk about what happens when they return home. And actually, again, the life adjustment to that is probably even harder because you don't always know exactly what you're going to do. John's always very open. He actually had quite significant mental health challenges, both before the trip, but particularly on return home. And I guess I didn't have a job when I came home. I moved back to Edinburgh. I was in my flat for 3 weeks, and actually I guess this is part of where the story, I guess, becomes tough again, actually, is because 3 weeks into trying to re-establish myself back into my old life, even though, as you say, it had moved on, friends had had children, all those kind of things, my mother actually at that point did become very unwell, and she went off her legs and became bedbound. And so I very quickly, I'd been in Edinburgh for 3 weeks trying to get my new life up and running again, and I quickly was packing a suitcase and rushing back down to the West Midlands. And I looked after my mother then for the next 12 months until she passed away. And I guess that gave me something that was my main focus as soon as I returned. But then you're at the point when that bit of your life's ended, and then you're back, what do I do now? I love Scotland. I can't ever imagine living anywhere other than, this beautiful, beautiful country. But I knew I didn't want to move back to the city. Part of what I'd decided I was leaving all those years before was my rather hectic social life as much as everything else. I didn't want to fall back into it. So started to look at different places to go and live, and at that point was looking all over Scotland. And I remember it really distinctly, actually, the day we were going to view a property out near Newton Stewart, and we were driving on the A75 near Carsleith. The sun was shining, which always helps, but it's beautiful in the rain as well, just in case anyone's listening.
Scotch rain can be beautiful.
Absolutely. But we both just looked at each other in the car and went, we want to live in Dumfries and Galloway. Yeah. And it was, again, it was just that flash moment where we knew it was exactly where we wanted to be. It was a part of Scotland I didn't know so well until I moved here. I'd worked for a national organisation, but you tend to get to Dumfries and stop sometimes. That's probably quite an admission, but it's true. And what a glorious place Dumfries and Galloway is. What an amazing place to live. And we have so much space. It's incredibly welcoming. Do I miss bits of the theatre? Some of that stuff? Yeah. Do I miss going to a gig? Yeah, I miss some of that stuff. But actually, you can go in and you can get to the city when you need to.
You can drop in and out of it.
Absolutely.
Can I just go back to your cycle ride?
Because of course.
I want to ask you a question that I often feel when I'm cycling, and I've not done London to John O'Groats, I think Kakuba to John O'Groats.
Okay.
But did you have that sense of total detachment from society when you're off on the travel?
Oh, gosh. You're living at a different pace, I think it's fair to say, to many of your friends and family. I talk actually about, in the book, about actually what you feel is an attachment to the landscape. And you feel an attachment to the landscape, I think, because you're going at that perfect speed where you're seeing it change, but you're part of it. So if someone took a photograph, you're in it.
Yeah.
So there was a real sense of perhaps not being... Yeah, maybe being cut off from society in the sense of you're on a different time schedule, but actually what you were in instead was very much that connection to nature, to landscape, and just to a much slower pace of life. It was, and you had moments where you'd nip back into something more society orientated, but a very different society to one that you're used to. So again, we had some incredible moments. I think particularly as we travelled through India, where school children would be out on the streets and they'd cheer us in. So you suddenly became part of their society and community, albeit for brief moments. Those kind of things, I think.
It's a bit like, you coming back to Edinburgh, a few moments ago you're saying about coming back to your flat. It sort of reminds me of, I was once in hospital, I was quite poorly, and I was away in hospital for nearly 3 or 4 weeks, and there was this sense of coming home, and I realised that I had just become institutionalised in hospital, and then home I really struggled for a day or two to adapt back from this cocooned institutionalised hospital where they'd really looked after me and I'd got better. And in a way, I felt the same when you said I got back to Edinburgh, that you'd sort of been in this bubble and then everything sort of changed when you got home again.
Yes, and it's exciting and exhausting all at the same time. So you're really excited to be seeing your friends and family again on one level. Mm-hmm. You're actually for a very long time, the only person I spoke to apart from strangers that we met along the way was John. So you've gone from having a very intensive relationship with one person, that actually he was back in Buckinghamshire and I was in Edinburgh when we came back. So you're one person you've spent all your time with has gone, which I guess is, that could be nursing staff, it could be, in my case it was my cycle buddy, and yet all the people I was now trying to connect with, one, I found it exhausting because I hadn't been used to speaking to so many people. I was kind of used to having something quite quiet. And like I say, my pace of life had changed. And even now, I probably don't keep up with my friends as much as I ever used to before the trip started, which is, I mean, I do. I'm pretty sociable still, but not like I used to be. And their lives have changed. So you've kind of got that mix. And you're also looking around and you're trying to work out, sometimes little things feel like they've changed, but you can't quite put your finger on it. And sometimes that's just, someone's moved house or And so the dynamics of relationships and friendships have changed, or whether that's in a work scenario, someone you used to work very closely with has moved on to another job. So even though you've got a connection with that person, what they're doing is now so different to what you knew them doing that it takes a while to build back those connections and relationships again.
And you, I'm sorry, Jerry, I'm hogging all the questions here. I will let you in a second, because we were lucky enough and honoured to do John and your wedding here at the Selkirk when you returned and settled into Dumfries and Galloway and came here. And then can we just touch on what happened after that and your diagnosis and where you are now? Is, I know it might be hard to talk about that, but I think you're the sort of person, and for those of you who aren't, you can't see Naomi, she's wearing around her neck a chain which has the word optimistic on it.
Yes.
And that's very much you, though.
Absolutely. I actually bought this necklace when I was diagnosed.
Yeah.
Because I felt I've always been optimistic, and I need to remind myself? No, but I almost felt I needed to remind other people that I have a positive take on life. So again, I got diagnosed with breast cancer on the 1st of August. I was due to get married 6 weeks later. So, you know, straight away, having thought I had a cyst, this came out of the blue. So your automatic reaction to it was... It's pretty hard, especially with my mother's history of diagnosis as well. So you're the first few weeks, I think, particularly of not knowing. And I'd say this to anyone going through a tough diagnosis. I always say it's much easier to, even if it's negative, it's much easier to deal with things once you've got certainty. Yeah. Uncertainty is very difficult for anyone, I think. So I've been really fortunate. My journey, I had two chemo sessions before I got married. My hair fell out literally the evening of my wedding. So it started to come out 3 or 4 days before, and I just didn't comb it and just tried to keep it on my head for as long as possible. And it lasted, and it's just starting to come back again for those who don't see me. And actually in the last 3 weeks, I have had appointments with my consultants. I've still been now through chemotherapy and through surgery, and I've pretty much got an all clear.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So, you know, there is real hope, and that optimism has got me through, but I think equally has got friends and family through, more importantly. So, and one of the big things I talk about in the book and at the end is, you know, we had a bit of a catchphrase as we went through: one life, one opportunity. And I hope when I do talks about the book, we're really keen that we touch on the human aspects, that whole sense of how do you fit your dreams and visions in and amongst that family circumstance, which is where I found myself. How do you make sure you don't put things off until it's too late? So how do we really live in the present rather than always think, I'll do that when I retire? And, you know, my perspective on that's changed even in the last few months following my diagnosis. And we touch very much even on the mental health issues, because I think all of this stuff is what makes us human. And people tell me that certainly when they read the book or hear me speak, that actually it's refreshing to hear it from someone who, I describe myself as a non-athlete. My PE teachers at school would be gobsmacked I've done anything like this. I was the biggest skiver of sport you've ever seen. So all of that mixed in, I hope we give a sense of inspiration to other people.
Holiday. I'm going on holiday on Wednesday next week. It's in my case.
Fabulous.
So I might be messaging you from a cruise ship in the Caribbean, telling you how it's going.
Nice.
Or maybe in tears at certain parts of it, I'm sure. I'm quite an emotional person.
Yeah.
Jerry, do you want to ask Naomi a final question before we... wrap up?
I'm just conscious, I'm in the book reading it at the moment, and you're talking about something I think you display in the book, and indeed in this discussion, kind of like, you know, I would say a paradoxical relationship, which is about speed and slowness in a way. And again, you know, obviously there's a slow movement, and the book in praise of slow that influenced lots of us, but it's getting that, I like that balance in life, and you know, Chris is a bit like this as well. I like absolutely sticking my feet up and being in other spaces while being like hyper, speedy. But how do you do that? How do you live life with that, some sense of slowness and space?
What a really interesting question. Because anyone that knows me would probably never use the word slow to describe me at all.
No.
I'm juggling lots of plates all at the same time. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting. Even when I came back, I had this idea that I could move into this much slower environment. But actually, I find it very difficult because I'm just interested and curious about so many things. But we all have those sides of ourselves, I guess,
that's right.
We show, and those sides that people don't see. So, you know, when people see me, certainly, whether that's in my work environment or my living environment, I rushed in here today, 2 minutes late, you know, going, oh, I've just been doing this and now I'm off to this appointment. But actually, I've learned how to build the slowness into my life these days through dog walking.
Exactly. Same here.
Through piano playing. But I still can only find slowness by doing something.
Yeah,
I'm a bit like that as well.
Because my partner will say to me, you're never actually not doing something. If you're sitting relaxing, you're always like reading something, and that could be even reading for a purpose, you know. But yeah, dog walking is definitely something. I go to church now. I never went to church in Glasgow. You know, again, there's different ways.
Yeah.
And this town, I think, in this area, there is a, without making it sound cliche, there's a way that you talk to people that is different from being in a city. I'm sure you found that as well.
There is. There's a pace in Dumfries and Galloway that can be, at times, when you've been used to that city pace, incredibly frustrating. I also have a sense of these folks have got it right.
Exactly.
You know, and all of that mixed in at the same time in terms of a pace of life is that, yeah, absolutely, I want to maximise getting the most out of it, which I think is the speed bit. But actually, do you always get the most? There's something about depth. There's something about not doing everything just in a slapdash and quick way, so that you do some things properly. So again, and there'll be some things in my life I do properly and really go into depth in, and there'll be some things that I roughly have a go at and then quickly move on. And my poor piano teacher would probably say that about most of my approach to learning new pieces. Once I've pretty much cracked it, I'm not worried about perfection. I want to learn something new. And those characteristics come through, I think, in everything I probably do.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to come and hear Naomi live talking about a book, The World at 15 Miles Per Hour-ish, she is on Saturday, March the 9th, 2 o'clock, at the Dark Art Distillery. Chance probably for a gin there as well, I suspect. With your tickets are £6, they're available at Kakubri Book Week website. Naomi, thank you so much for coming to join us.
That was lovely.
A real pleasure, And I look forward to seeing people at Book Week. It's brilliant to see Kakubri doing this.
Looking forward to seeing you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.